This is Topical Talks by Title Research, the podcast about estate administration, probate, and all other areas in the wills and probate legal sector.
Welcome to this episode of Topical Talks with Title Research. My name is Anthony Alsop, and I'm head of business here. Today, I'm joined by Holly Mieville-Hawkins, Senior Associate at Enable Law, and Andrea Pierce, Legal Services Director at Title Research. Topical Talks is a podcast brought to you by Genealogical Research and Asset Repatriation Specialists, Title Research. In each episode, we speak to highly regarded legal professionals about their area of expertise and views on current popular topics of conversation. Let me give you a brief introduction to today's guest. Holly is a member of the Mental Capacity Team at Enable Law. She is an expert in the field of court protection work, specialising in making and defending applications. She is also a member of the Law Society Wills and Equity Committee, a fully accredited member of Solicitors for the Elderly, a committee member for South West Copper, and works closely with the Office of the Public Guardian as a stakeholder. Today we'll be focusing our conversation on inheritance tax planning and court protection. Welcome, Holly.
Thank you.
And welcome, Andrea.
Thank you.
Over to you, Andrea.
Hello, Holly. So you're very welcome to today's podcast. And as Anthony said, we're going to concentrate this conversation on the court of protection and in particular, you know, IHG planning, inheritance tax planning. And I just thought maybe we could start there. And
yep.
If you could talk about, firstly, that connection between, you know, the inheritance tax planning when somebody is incapable.
Yeah, of course. As Anthony said, my day-to-day life is very much sort of preoccupied with dealing with the affairs of people that can't make those decisions for themselves. I sort of am a professional deputy, and I also, you know, make applications on behalf of professional deputies and on behalf of professional attorneys to the Court of Protection, where they need special permission to do things, and that can often include applications to make a gift. And often, applications to make a gift are made alongside questions of inheritance tax, because a lot of the time, attorneys will look at, deputies will look at the affairs of the person that they are managing and realise that if they don't take some sort of planning action regarding their assets and their affairs, there might be quite a hefty inheritance tax bill to pay in 5-10 years or so when the person who they're representing passes away. And the reason that gifting and inheritance tax planning are so interlinked is because a lot of the time, the best way of sort of diminishing a person's estate to ensure that inheritance tax doesn't take the bulk of their estate is to make gifts during their lifetime and sort of to bring into play the rules about gifting and sort of the tapering relief that is given when you make a gift over 7 years after that gift is made. And obviously this becomes quite a problem a lot of the time, because a lot of the time it's children that are making those applications, and it's also children that are the beneficiary of the gifts. And so a lot of the time there's quite a significant conflict of interest where the person that's making the application is also the beneficiary of the gift. And that's why the Court of Protection are incredibly strict about what they will allow on a basic day-to-day level in terms of gifting and what needs additional authority by the Court of Protection.
So sticking to the theme of gifting in particular, do you find that attorneys or even like lay deputies think that they just got this carte blanche approach to gifting, and you know, just because it, you know, the person who now sadly is incapable can't do that anymore, they just think, oh well, we better start thinking about
absolutely
it.
I mean, honestly, one of the reasons I agreed to do this podcast is because I am a huge proponent of banging the drum of education in terms of the wider community and the wider sort of general public in England and Wales about what the duties and responsibilities of deputies and attorneys are. Because there's one camp of deputies and attorneys that are professionals, and we know the rules, and you know, we should know the rules, but there are other people who just almost by accident become attorneys or deputies and don't get a huge amount of guidance about what they should and shouldn't be doing. So a lot of the time, through absolutely no fault of their own, people make errors in terms of gifting. And they might, for example, this morning I was talking to a financial advisor, and he said at the end of the meeting, he said, oh Holly, can I just have a word with you a minute? because I just got a friend whose mum has become attorney for, sorry, whose wife has become attorney for her mum, and she's put 50,000 in premium bonds for herself and 50,000 in premium bonds for her mum. That's not okay, is it? And it was very clear that that's not okay. But actually, even this woman, who's quite an educated woman, didn't realise that you can't just put £50,000 into your own name, you know, and actually it'll be okay. So a lot of people, it's not willful ignorance, it's just not realising what the law is. I mean, and the law is really, really strict. It says that Section 12 of the Mental Capacity Act says that you can only make gifts in a very limited context, and that it says that you can only make gifts on customary occasions to persons that are related or connected with the donor, or any charity to whom the donor might have been expected to make gifts if the value of the gift is not unreasonable. So it's a really small exemption. Like, you really can't make significant gifts in any way, shape or form to anybody if you are an attorney or a deputy, unless you have additional authority from the Court of Protection to do so. And deputies aren't governed by that Section 12 provision, but in deputyship orders there'll be very clear provisions saying what a person can and can't do in terms of making gifts without additional authority.
So in relation to that approach by the Court of Protection, what is their approach? And, you know, are you starting to see some change in relation to particular inheritance tax planning?
I wouldn't say there's been a change, but I would say that there's been a couple of cases recently, which I'll touch on later, that have clarified the court's approach to when gifting applications are made. There's some really, really useful guidance that was published by the Office of the Public Guardian back in 2018 about gifting and what gifting is allowed and what gifting isn't allowed. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to just read off a piece of paper because I don't think that makes a great podcast, but actually I would really just like to highlight a paragraph because it's a really helpful piece of guidance.
Yep.
It says, there is no single approach to gifts that applies to every deputy and attorney. Attorneys and deputies have got to make each decision considering its own context and timing. As with all decisions a deputy or attorney makes, the main test is whether or not that gift is in a person's best interests. And I think that best interest test is the most important test to bear in mind at all times. And when you're thinking about best interest in relation to gifting and gift planning, you've not only got to look at Section 4 of the Mental Capacity Act, which is the standard best interest test, but, you know, and sort of look about whether or not, you know, a person's wishes and feelings said that they would like to make that gift, they've got a history of giving, you know, whether or not a person might be expected to make a gift in that scenario, you know, the standard Section 4 Mental Capacity Act best interest test, which I'm not going to go into in detail here because that's sort of beyond the remit of this podcast, but specifically applying that to gifting, you need to have a look at whether the person's got a history and a habit of making gifts or a loan of a particular size, the person's life expectancy, the possibility that a person might have to pay for care costs or care home fees in the future, the amount of the gift, if it's affordable, if it's on a customary occasion, whether or not the gift might interfere with previous inheritance, sort of testamentary dispositions of the person, like previous wills. And also, lastly, you've got to then consider the impact of inheritance tax on the person's death. So actually, when you're thinking about making gifts and the best interests of a person, whether or not that gift might be appropriate or not, only one factor of all of the factors you need to consider are the inheritance tax consequences of that gift. So you've got to be really careful to not let the tax tail wag the gifting dog, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's something very particular, isn't there, in statute about gifts out of income and that, you know, that type of thing. And are you starting to see families look at those?
Yes, I mean, see, I'll touch on that a bit later, actually, because one of the most recent cases specifically deals with the issue, the distinction between capital and income gifting. But I think what might be quite helpful for me just to touch on before we go into detail about the cases, mm-hmm, is the sort of de minimis exemption, which means sort of like the amount that attorneys are allowed to gift without getting additional authority from the Court of Protection. So I talked very briefly about you know, the customary occasions bit a minute ago. What the Court of Protection have quite usefully done is that they published a case back in 2013 called MJ and JM and the Public Guardian, and they gave the guidance that where a person's estate is worth at least the value of the nil rate band, which is, you know, around £325,000, you know, depending on the person's circumstances, they've got a life expectancy of less than 5 years, and the gifts are affordable and they won't adversely affect the standard of care and the quality of the person's life. And additionally, there's no evidence that the person would be opposed to those gifts, going back to that best interest assessment at all times. Then in that situation, in that limited circumstance, the gifts that can be made without further authority from the Court of Protection is one gift of capital of £3,000 a year and small gifts of £250,000 per person up to a maximum of about 10 people. Anything over and above that will need additional authority from the Court of Protection. And there was a really good case in 2014, which I just thought I'd talk about really briefly because it made me laugh, where it was a donor appointed two attorneys to be, was it her two sons to be her attorneys, and one of them was a financial advisor, and he set up standing orders to himself every month of £250. And he said, and I quote, "It would have been unprofessional not to take the opportunity of structuring his mother's affairs when he was given it." So, you know, he thought, 250 quid a month to myself, that's my professional duty. The court thought otherwise and removed him and his brother as attorneys and said they were no longer able to be attorneys and ordered them to repay all of the money.
Oh, that's what I was going to ask you, actually.
Yeah.
So they, you know, they have got a right of recourse.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I mean, they can't actually order someone to repay funds, but what they can do is say that a statutory will application needs to be made and that those gifts that had previously been received need to be taken into account in that change of will. So they don't have powers to enforce
debt. That's really
interesting. But they can get someone to change. They can say that a will needs to be made to take into account any previous gifts, sort of like on the hodgepodge basis.
Yeah.
So,
and you started to see that.
Very much so. That's really an approach that's taken a lot. I mean, not just in published cases, but I mean, yesterday I submitted a statutory will application to the Court of Protection on that basis. So
from
the only I just did a statutory codicil to bring into account the hodgepodge, the gifts that have been made on the hodgepodge basis. So it happens quite a lot of the time.
Yeah.
It's quite a standard approach by the court.
Yeah. And I think that's great, isn't it? Because you're then capturing it in the lifetime.
Yeah.
Whereas my perception is that you know, that fraud in this area, and whilst it's going off topic a little bit, it's still interlinked, isn't
it? It's huge.
Because, you know, the gifting, in inverted commas, or the spending as though it's their own money is becoming more of an issue.
I think it's because money's becoming more and more valuable. Like, I think there's a sort of perceived injustice between generations. I think that the younger generations sort of see that their parents got, you know, large houses, good pensions, good pay, and that they don't have that, and they sort of see the inheritance as theirs before it is theirs.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, I don't think people are trying to be fraudulent most of the time. I think people just don't really understand the law and the distinction between whose property belongs to who. They see it as their inheritance.
Yeah.
And I see that quite a lot, to be honest.
And I know you said at the very beginning that, you know, it will be about education, but is there anything else that can happen? You know, is there something that UK Finance can work on with the banks?
I think it would be really helpful. I mean, I sit on the Wills and Equity Committee for the Law Society, and as a result I have quite regular meetings with the Public Guardian's office and with the Public Guardian himself, and I know that it's something that he's really passionate about, is making sure that banks and building societies work more closely with the Public Guardian's office in order to produce guidance about what is appropriate uses of funds and what isn't appropriate uses of funds. So I know that that's something that's a bit of a priority for the Public Guardian's office, and I think it would be really helpful for banks to buy into the guidance that the OPG have also already put out.
And, you know,
it's about that buy-in.
And the banks have clever technology as well.
They really
have
do.
Some algorithms to work out, you know, oh gosh, this person is now in
care.
They shouldn't be spending money.
£250 a day out of the cash machine.
Quite.
I think the banks could do a lot more than they are doing to prevent the crimes that are being committed against, frankly, the most vulnerable in our society and the ones that need the most protection.
Yeah. So. And I know that we interviewed Michael Culver from the Solicitors for the Elderly some time back, and you know, I know that they're very passionate at doing, you know, working in this space and, you know, working with UK Finance.
And the banks have the technology.
That
there's no reason to not put this in place apart from commercial reality.
Yeah.
I suppose they don't. I suppose it's cheaper for them to not do anything about it.
And what about in relation to mirroring some of the processes that you have with a deputyship?
Well,
the bond in particular, putting that in.
That's on the horizon, very much on the horizon. Yeah, no, absolutely, it's coming in. Yeah, yeah. So Deputy Bond Services are looking at it now, and it's very much on the horizon. I don't think it will be compulsory, because actually a lot of the time some attorneys, some donors of attorneyships don't really have any money at all, like they must still around the 30,000 mark, so it would be kind of disproportionate use of their funds to have a bond. But I think it might be an optional thing, and I think then, you know, then donors could put in their power of attorney document, I want a bond to be taken out, you know. So I think, yeah, I think it's a really positive step if that comes into place as an option.
And also, you know, OBG pushing, you know, both the donor and the attorney towards some kind of professional advice as well.
100%.
It's, we can all do it. We can all go onto the website and we can create a lasting power of attorney in particular. So is there some change that you'd like to see?
Well, I've taken this up directly with both, you know, the last Public Guardian, Owen Eccles, and the new Public Guardian, and I've said, look, come on, you've got to prioritise the need for legal advice. And their argument back to me is always that most of the time you don't need legal advice, because most of the time you're just doing day-to-day things, doing admin and sort of managing your bank account. And I think probably 70% of the time they're right, but 30% of the time people do need some legal advice, and it's not disproportionate to get that legal advice in terms of what your duties are, what they should and shouldn't be doing. Because the OPG, you know, credit where credit's due, have produced brilliant guidance to attorneys. It's really thorough, it's really detailed, but the attorneys aren't compelled to read it, and they don't read it a lot of the time. So, you know, and actually I think having maybe some form of podcast training or webinar training on becoming an attorney, or even when you're taking on the role, when you're signing the attorneyship.
So
in the first
is there
place,
something
might be
about
sensible.
Timing as well? So under, for those who can remember, the old enduring power of attorney regime, you'd register that when someone was becoming or become incapable.
Yeah.
So it's more prevalent, it's more in your mind as, you know, this is my duty as an attorney now. Whereas if you're registering it when somebody's, you know, perfectly able,
but,
and then you stop, and then when it's kicked in.
But obviously the Mental Capacity Act, being structured in the way that it is, requires really that the LPA is registered immediately, because in a fluctuating capacity, and that is very much the underpinning score of the Mental Capacity Act, that you can do capacity to have some do some things and not have capacity to do other things, time and issue specific, etc. So I think it's right that the power of attorney is registered and ready and waiting just in case it's needed. But I think that maybe the OBG could keep in touch more.
Then I think that's my point. There's an extra step missing, potentially.
Yeah.
But then highlights to the attorney, right, this is now your role. This is what you need to do. Even if it's...
Maybe it's a trigger
when
it gets registered at the banks, maybe.
Or, you know, you could... An online test. You know,
10
questions
online.
You know,
are you qualified to be an attorney? Maybe a trigger factor could be when the banks get the registered power of attorney in, because people only register it really when they need to use it. So maybe that could then send information back to the Public Guardian's office, and then at that point guidance could be sent out. I don't know.
Going back to the topic of the podcast, you could easily say, oh, you know, what are the limits for gifting?
Yeah, no, absolutely, and it's easy, and they're not complicated limits. They are there, and they're set out in black and white. So, and yeah, do you want me to go back to gifting
a little bit? Let's go back to gifting.
So
I think we kind of, you know, got to the point where we're talking about authority and what's laid down in statute. But I think what would be really good for the listeners to hear is some, you know, you gave us the funny example of the professional, the 250 every month, but are there some other examples that bring this to the fore?
Funny you should ask. But in the last sort of 6 months to 8 months, the Court of Protection have published two really good and quite juicy, interesting cases about sort of how the court would approach applications for gifting in the context of inheritance tax planning. They're two really different cases, actually, but they're both really relevant. So I'll sort of run through the facts, each of them sort of quickly, and sort of say what legal principles we can take from them.
Yeah, they do. Thank you.
Because I always think that sort of like a bit of facts give a bit of flavour and you're more likely to remember it. So the first is PBC and JMA and others, and that's 2018 case EWCOP19 for those geeks that want to look it up. In this case, P was born on the 15th of December 1945, so she's in her mid-70s. She got early onset Alzheimer's and she needs full-time care. Wheelchair bound, no longer able to converse. Her sister said that she can sort of recognise loved ones and sort of smile when you enter her room, but that's sort of like the limit of her ability to communicate. Life expectancy somewhere around 3 to 5 years. She had one surviving child and one grandchild, but her personal wealth was in the region of £18.5 million, mostly derived from her fourth husband, who's known as R.A., who sold his business for about £11 million. She and her husband, late husband, had a really significant history of gifting to charities, and also to her son, PBC, who'd got about £950,000 during his lifetime, and you know, while she had capacity by way of both property and cash gifts. And what's very relevant in this case is that during her life, during her capacitated lifetime and her late husband's lifetime, they took a lot of inheritance. They took a lot of tax advice about lifetime taxes, like capital gains tax, income tax, but they didn't seek inheritance tax advice. But they accidentally got inheritance tax advice, so incidental to the other tax advice that they were seeking. And what's also relevant in this case is that her late husband had left his whole estate to P, and in his letter of wishes and in his will, he said, "I want you to specifically consider who I would benefit if I hadn't left all the money to you," because obviously he had not other family, but he had his own wishes and feelings about charities that should benefit. And so in this application, everyone was agreed actually about what the outcome should be. And so they made an application to the Court of Protection. The applicant was the son. So it just goes back to what I was saying earlier about it, you know, attorneys and children often are the ones that are making the application. And he wanted £6 million outright gift to himself out of capital. And he wanted £50,000 to be made, gift of each £50,000 to be made to each of the charities that were named in the late husband's will. And a gift of £422,800. Don't ask me why, it's very specific. And a discretionary settlement to the grandson, where he's the primary beneficiary. The inheritance tax consequences of those gifts would be quite significant.
Mm,
so
definitely.
If she had died like immediately before the application had gone through, the IHT bill would be £6.2 million.
Yeah.
If the gifts were made, so on the day of the gifts being made, it would taper to £5.6 million. And if she died 7 years later, it would be £3 million. So there's a difference of £3 million in inheritance tax that would be affected by these gifts being made. So it's quite significant and really worth looking at. She was unable to express any views about these proposed gifts, but the application was made on the basis that it would be in her best interest for these gifts to be made because of the saving to IHT. Now, the court looked at the application and said, look, why are those gifts benefiting P? I can see they're benefiting her family, but I'm not really sure that's what's benefiting P. They also asked how these gifts would be in accordance with the donor's past and present wishes and feelings, values and beliefs, etc., etc., as per the best interest test, and also whether proper consideration had been given to the expression of wishes in the will of her late husband. Now, the court were presented with a very interesting argument by the applicant, and I think it's really worth sort of drawing the listener's attention to it. The applicant argued very clearly that best interests is not synonymous with self-interests, and this is confirmed in a number of cases and also in the Code of Practice for the Mental Capacity Act, which says at paragraph 5.47 and 5.48 that section 4.6c of the Act, which is the best interest legislation, requires decision makers to consider any other factors the person who lacks capacity would consider if they were able to do so. This might include the effect of the decision on other people, obligations to dependents, or the duties of a responsible citizen. Now, the court looked at that and they considered the case of Re G brackets TJ in 2010. And that case says that it's long been accepted that the maintenance of others that P has got obligations towards can be in their best interests. And the court nicely summarised at paragraph 51 of the judgment the question that basically they were being asked in this case. They said, the court is being asked to consider if those persons she wanted to benefit could be in the position of benefiting a little bit more in order to get a tax saving. So basically, is it of benefit to P that the people she wanted to benefit are even further benefited by the fact that they aren't paying tax on the amount that they would be benefiting from? The applicant argued that his mother's circumstances had changed since she was last able to consider tax planning, and that's why she didn't take inheritance tax advice, because she was younger when she was making the when she was making her previous will and looking at sort of making gifts. And the court concluded as follows. It declined to accept that there's any base point at all for assuming that any particular person would want to mitigate tax, no matter how sensible or vanilla those tax savings are. It's very clear that each case in each circumstance turns on its own facts. It refused to look at the actual financial savings to UP of the gifts as being either a positive or a negative thing. But it did say that the savings benefit her family, and therefore those family benefits were subsumed into the balance sheet in a positive way because of the benefit to her family, because she would want to protect and provide for her family. So it wasn't a good thing in itself for P, it was only good because her family would benefit. Affordability is a necessary but not sufficient condition for making lifetime gifts, which sounds like absolute legalese, but what it really means is that it's critical that any gifts are affordable, but just because they're affordable doesn't make it right. Okay, and in this particular circumstance, the court agreed with all the application that was being made, because all of the families and the charities were in agreement with the proposed gifts. There's a clear history of gifting to those charities and to her son. Her late husband's will was respected because the charities he wanted to benefit were also being benefited. She had a history of seeking tax planning advice, and whilst that concentrated on lifetime planning, that was probably because she was younger when she was taking it. The gifts were more than affordable to her, and her son was her attorney, which suggests that she had a great deal of faith and trust in him. Last point, potentially debatable given the history of the cases I deal with on a day-to-day basis, but that's a summary of that situation, and I think it's a really interesting case, and
yeah.
It gives us some really clear guidance to move forward with.
But it does definitely fall on the facts, doesn't it,
mm-hmm.
as well? And as you were talking, it was kind of, I was wondering, is there something that professionals should be asking when doing our lasting powers of attorney, and you know, ask me about that history of gifting, because
yeah.
you know, not all families are aware of it. Yeah,
absolutely.
You can go through, you know, bank statements, but it's tricky to do that sometimes.
I think what came out of this case, it was quite relevant to me actually, because when I was writing this talk, I was dealing with a case done in the Court of Protection. It was a contended case, and the case I was dealing with, a lot of the decision that was made in that case sort of turned on advice that had been received by professionals during that person's lifetime, and actually what was exhibited to the court were professionals' notes, records of conversations, telephone calls and that sort of thing that she'd had with her accountants and her solicitors during
mm-hmm.
her lifetime.
Yeah.
And I think that there's sort of like two points of best practice that sort of could come from the case that we've just looked at, and the first is that actually conversations with professionals are paramount importance, and so attendance notes are crucial, and I think they're going to be becoming increasingly so.
Yeah.
But the second point is exactly what you were saying, that actually at the point of making the lasting power of attorney, I think that solicitors need to be looking at having that really open conversation with the donors and saying, what sort of gifting would you want to be made? I mean, do you think that's appropriate? Would you like to ban it? You can't stop attorneys doing things, but would you like to express your preferences now in this written form, in your power of attorney, in your preferences and instructions boxes about what you would and wouldn't like done with your assets
mm-hmm.
further down the line,
yeah.
if the question arose?
Yeah. And you know, having some kind of schedule if they did.
Yeah, absolutely.
You
know,
just separate within the file.
Yeah.
So. You said you had another case.
Yes,
do you
want to
go through that as well?
No,
because I think it's really good, isn't it? Just
okay.
To give a bit of flavour.
It's a very different case, this next one. It's called FL and MJL by his litigation friend, the official solicitor, and it's 2019 case, EWCOP 31. For those that want to know, the case of MJL is really sad and really unusual, but again the legal principles that flow from it are really important. It's really awful, this case. He was in his mid-50s when he had a sudden heart attack, which resulted in him being left in a persistent vegetative state. The heart attack was entirely unexpected, and he hadn't made a will. His brother was his financial deputy for financial affairs and the sole deputy, and he had four other siblings. The family wealth was really high here. All of the siblings were independently wealthy to the tune of sort of 17 to 20 million pounds each, largely from inherited wealth, and P actually had 17 million pounds in his estate. He also received NHS funding for his care, so he
right.
didn't have any need for
no.
that money. His income was around 120,000 a year from that inheritance, and his outgoings were about 16,000 a year, so he had a surplus income
yeah.
of about 104,000 a year. During his lifetime, P was really outspoken in terms of his left-leaning principles. He supported a lot of left-wing charities. He was a Labour supporter. He was a charity trustee. He, during his lifetime, directed that a further inheritance of 2.4 million be directed to those in need rather than come to him. He had a job. He lived off the income of his job. He didn't manage his money whatsoever. He didn't take any financial advice. He had a huge bill from HMRC because he didn't manage his finances. He just had no interest at all in his money, and he didn't value money at all. And that's really relevant when it comes to the decision that the court made. And in fact, when in 2010 an application was made for a statutory will and 40% of his estate was left to charity, with only 60% of his estate going to friends and family. So the application, I won't go into too much detail in terms of the application that was made, but one thing that was applied for was sort of authority to ratify past gifts that were really small, in terms of small gifts to charities, sort of like a couple of hundred here and there. And the court dealt with that immediately and just said, look, there's no need to apply for ratification of those small gifts because they fall within that de minimis exemption that I spoke about earlier. But what they did apply for was authority to make future gifts of about just over £1 million from accumulated surplus income from the years 2009 to 2017, which is sort of since his accident, since his heart attack until the date of the application. And then about £800,000 to charitable beneficiaries from capital. And then authority for future surplus income to be made to siblings and future capital to charities. The court looked at this and their view was actually it's really important that there's a distinction between income and capital gifting. They thought it was very important that gifts made from capital are outright gifts and they're not pets. They just fall out of an estate immediately as soon as they're made. Rather gifts from capital. And they applied the balance sheet test that is applied in all best interest cases, and their view was as follows. It was really important that P didn't engage in any tax planning, and as a result of that, tax planning is a completely neutral element when making this decision. It's not a bad thing, it's not a good thing. They're just refusing to look at any history of tax planning when looking at his case. The funds that were proposed to be gifted had absolutely no material effect whatsoever on the lifestyles or the wealth of the siblings because they were all hugely independently wealthy in their own rights, and therefore there was no effect of happiness or enhancement that would be made as a result of those gifts. He actually struggled with his own wealth and lived a really modest lifestyle. Therefore, actually, he didn't see cash gifts as having any inherent value. And so you couldn't say that he would have wanted money to be gifted. And they were far more than anything he'd made during his lifetime. During his lifetime, he'd only made sort of like a couple of £100 gifts here and there. So he had no history of gifting. But he did have a clear history of charitable giving, and therefore that must be taken into account. Further, and this I think really important, is that his left-leaning principles would have not necessarily prevented him from considering tax planning, but would have probably prevented him from doing any aggressive tax planning because he'd wanted the state to benefit.
Yeah.
And also, his care was being provided by the state, and he probably would have wanted to pay the state back for that. So the court looked at this, and they ratified the past gifts, so you know, the de minimis allowance, that's absolutely fine, a couple of hundred quid a year to charities. But what they said was, the immediate gift from surplus accrued income should go 60% to siblings and 40% to charities, just as the will did. And then ongoing gifts of surplus income, 60% to siblings, 40% to charities. They would not allow any gift from capital to be made, only from income. And I suppose the principles that can be taken from this case are, again, just because a gift is affordable doesn't mean that it should be made. Again, complete rejection of any default position regarding tax planning. P's approach to tax planning during their lifetime and their approach to charities, how they lived and the effect of any gifts that might be made are hugely important. The court would be more willing, I suppose, to accept gifts from surplus income than capital. And also the provisions of a statutory will are really important. So that's sort of the take home from that case.
Still interesting, but also, you know, there's still an element of tax planning that was done.
Yeah.
Just not to the full extent that they wanted.
Yeah,
so it was still worth it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, it's also huge in the context of it.
And so you mentioned about ratifying retrospective gifting.
Yeah.
Would you encourage
100%
attorneys to do this?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, not doing so is just a ticking time bomb.
Yeah.
Like, I am such a proponent of people taking legal advice early, getting everything laid out on the table, talking to people, getting applications that are put together where everyone agrees and presenting that to the court. Rather than trying to hide things or bury your head in the sand or not admitting what your duties and responsibilities are, I've never known a case where trying to avoid your duties and responsibilities saves money in the long run. It just escalates cost and time and
whilst
delay.
You're not doing it on a day-to-day basis, are you seeing the impact that that's having on estate administration when they die?
Yeah, hugely. And a lot of the time I try and do the estate administrator's job for them when I'm a professional deputy, and I try and streamline someone's affairs and effects and everything like that if I can, get statutory will in place, make sure the professional executor in place, etc, etc. But if there's not that professional deputy in place, you're just leaving a huge mess for your executors to sort out, whether that's your friends, family, siblings or professionals. It's always more costly to avoid a problem than to face a problem.
Yeah. And with your crystal ball on the table, what changes would you like to see? What changes do you think are on the horizon?
I think just to get on my political bandwagon, or my pedestal, there's got to be an increase to the SCCO rates that deputies are allowed to charge. I mean, at the moment, we're only allowed to charge what we were allowed to charge 10 years ago. And I'm not trying to be greedy. I'm not a partner in my law firm or anything like that. But the result of that is that the rates we're being able to charge are so dramatically lower than what the private rates are,
mm-hmm.
that the deputyship work is being ground down to the sort of cheapest person that can do it, and the skill is being taken out of it, and that's just not MP's benefit. A lot of firms are now taking a very paralegal heavy approach to deputyship work, and sort of the very little legal support and supervision being given to those cases. And actually, just as I think what this podcast has established, actually you need to have legal oversight, and you need to have someone that's got the experience and the knowledge of all of the sort of areas where things could go wrong, and the red flags. It doesn't have to all be managed by solicitor all the time, but it has got to have the right level of supervision being done.
No.
And I think there's a real risk that it's being commodified in a way that isn't in P's best interest.
No, and something that I've spoken about before is also the kind of the softer skills as well, that you need in, you know, especially in this area.
You're dealing with people. And families that are in a difficult situation.
Yeah, and you know, you go back to, you know, when you were, you know, late teens, early 20s, and you know, what life experience have you got to kind of deal with this type of thing?
I had a baby girl just over 4.5 years ago now, and I think that was the best thing that could possibly have happened to me in my career, because you realise just how much love a person has for a child. And I don't think I truly really understood that, and I deal a lot with birth cases, birth injury cases, and like, I just think it may be an infinitely better solicitor to have that life experience, you know, so there we are.
What needs to be done in that regard, do you think?
As I said, I think the SCCO rates need to go up.
Yeah. But also, no, just about the softer skills. You know, obviously then...
life experience,
the more experience, then we'll end up working on a case. But actually, there's something that we can do around, I don't know, is there something you can do when you're doing your law degree or legal practice course, or is there, you know, is there...
I think people need to get out and meet each other more, to a certain extent, because I think a lot of the time, like, training is even done now virtually, like podcasts, webinars, that sort of thing. And actually, I think people meet people less and less, because you can work from home, you can do everything virtually really now, and so actually I don't think people get the experience that they would otherwise do at handling more difficult situations
and hiding behind emails.
People do that,
you're right.
I think it's an easy thing to do, but actually I think people need to pick up the phone a little bit more and go meet people a little bit more, get under people's skin, and just go, it's that X factor, it's that sixth sense of walking into a room and working out really where the feelings and emotions are, you know, and just going with that sort of unsaid thing.
Yeah. And also, so, I know you're coming in a little bit later, you know, when somebody probably is, you know, incapable of dealing with their affairs, but actually, you know, before that,
and they can express a hell of a lot.
How do you even assess somebody?
Yeah, I mean, there's no substitute for going and meeting someone.
No
matter how ill they might be, even if they are in a persistent vegetative state,
you can
tell a lot just from, you know, being in a room with somebody.
Yeah, I agree. Well, Holly, thank you. A huge thank you for that.
Pleasure.
I hope that
thanks for inviting me in.
All the listeners found it useful.